Welcome to our podcast. Good news, we are currently running a special promotion for new HedgEye podcast listeners. Get your first month free to any one of our investing products for brand new HedgEye subscribers. Email Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com to get yours. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back to Real Conversations, where this time we get to talk about Bitcoin, and I'm going to talk with Josh Crum, who's been on Real Conversations many times. You might remember him as the Goldman commodities strategist. He's also the co-founder of Gold Money. He's got a lot to say on this topic. We want to hear back a lot of feedback here. I'm in learning mode on this, so don't call me a bull or a bear. I'm going to be what I want to be, and that's when I decide to be. So at the end of the day, I think, Josh, you would probably say that your views are somewhat not jumping all in on a certain crypto or whatever it may be either. That's not to mean that you're non-committal and don't have knowledge on the matter, but I guess first, why do you have a view on cryptocurrency? Why do you think that your view matters?
Thanks, Keith. Good to be back. I should probably start the discussion by saying I've got an engineering degree, but I'm not an engineer. And I've got an economics degree, and I'm not an economist. So I'm going to probably mess up a little bit of both the engineering and economics in this. But, first off, from my business standpoint, so I'm not, writing research or sitting around analyzing the market all day. I mean, I, fundamentally am running three businesses right now. But they're very important because I think this is such an important macro topic. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the market cap, 5 months ago, 6 months ago, it was an interesting conversation at dinner tables. But with a $500 billion market capitalization, this is now very real. This matters. There's a capital behind this that we all need to be thinking about regardless if we think it's just a Super Mario coin or not. The market is telling us there's something important here that's happening. And, even if you say this is just the ultimate bubble and, that 500 millions or 500 billion is not a real number, I mean, if you look at the 50-day moving average, we're still at about 250 billion. If you look at the 200-day, we're probably edging up on 125, 150 billion. Mm-hmm. So, again, no matter how you look at it, this is a real asset class. Mm-hmm. And so now we have to ask why. What is it saying? And then from a, I'm not here to pitch the business, but, we've recently at Gold Money, our core business is being, a safe and trusted custodian of people's precious metal allocation. Mm-hmm. And I was approached by one of our big clients and shareholders probably about 6 months ago. And he basically said, look, this is real. Institutional money is coming. But the problem is we don't trust any of the exchanges, any of the custodians. None of them have public financials. None of them actually audit the holdings. I have no idea where I'm keeping my wealth. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to lose client money on price risk. It's another thing to lose the client's money just because you lost it. Mm. that's a zero.
That's a real problem.
that's a problem you can't have in the financial system, at least in the managed professional financial system. Yeah. And so we got into the market because you said, look, can you solve the custodial issues? You're a public company with audited financials. We trust you with gold. Can you come up with a solution so that institutions actually have a trusted place? So so we recently got into that business. So now you can purchase Bitcoin and custody Bitcoin with us, as well as the four precious metals and nine currencies. Mm-hmm. So that's why I guess I have some reason to be talking about it today.
Well, I mean that's a big component of something that you've worked on at a very early stage, and again, fortifying, if you will, people's wealth in a different way. And that's and you were well ahead of kind of this mania on that front. So again, for us, for guys like us, and I think you said as you were walking in here, like if you think of the cap associated with it relative to any base metal that you used to follow or you still follow concurrently, it's of consequence. So it's now it's on the list. That's the kind of the way that I look at it, which is it's one of the many things that I now follow. Yeah. It's got price. It's got volume. God willing, it'll keep me in volatility because now futures and options are trading. Right. So now I can analyze actually what the market's risk is implying on my terms, using my price, volume, volatility model. For example, that point, what do you think the futures market means for Bitcoin or for crypto? Some people say, well, that's the beginning of the beginning, and some people say it's the beginning of the end. I just think it's the beginning of having literal time series of data that I can measure and map.
For sure, but I think the most important part of a futures contract is what is the underlying? Like, what is the actual settlement?
Exactly.
And so if you look at the, you know, the CME futures is probably the one that's going to be, you know, the bigger of the two that just launched. And it's right now using a, you know, it's a cash settled future, you know, zero sum game, with the underlying being the average price of four different exchanges. Mm-hmm. But these four exchanges, you know, and one of them we use, actually two of them we use ourselves. So, you know, I think they are progressing and doing things right. But still, remember, these four exchanges, for the most part, a lot of them still have banking problems. It's still hard to get money in and out of them, mm-hmm. you know. And so this is very different than trading futures on a currency or an equity or even a commodity that cash settles with a very, anchored industrial cash price and use like the oil contract or mm-hmm. natural gas. So this is still a very interesting market because the cash settlement market is still so volatile and unprofessional in many ways.
Mm-hmm. How quickly do you think that just having futures trade will help that evolve and the next steps and the next?
I mean, some of this is a bit reflexive.
A bit. You're right. To your point, exactly. Money drives drives the expedition of this story.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the point that I think you led with on asking this question, so at Goldman. We didn't, for instance, we didn't really trade the silver market or the lead market. As an analyst, I didn't even really cover them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wrote reports, and we do obviously, service clients on various things, but the markets just simply weren't big enough to be a part of. You know, we really started with, zinc, aluminum, copper, and then obviously gold, platinum, palladium. And on that point, the annual production of Bitcoin now at 12 and a half blocks, produced, 12 and a half coins produced every 10 minutes when a new block is solved. The annual production is now larger than the silver market. It's larger than the lead market, mm-hmm. and we're approaching zinc. And then, if the price doubled from there, we'd had aluminum, we'd had copper. It's still probably only 10% of the gold market. But again, this is now getting into those levels of value.
It's real money that
people are going to be forced to trade this asset class.
In that regard, it's absolutely not like tulips. I mean, right. Tulips certainly weren't part, at least for guys like us. We never analyzed tulips, but we did analyze many subcomponents of the base metals. And to your point, there's a cap to this. There's a bid, there's an ask, there are futures contracts. We know what to do with those, or at least we try to, yeah. Which is the other point. But it's interesting that you compared it to a bunch of base metal commodities.
Right.
A lot of people call it a currency. Some people are like, no, it's not a currency, it's a technology. Mm-hmm. So what is it?
this is the biggest question. And by the way, we haven't solved this question since Marx and Ricardo were fighting about this, money versus currency.
I don't think we have to solve that here.
Or the money veil issue. I mean, all of these things. But it's actually quite important because...
Yeah. Well, I think it's important for the sales pitch. Like, if you're big-time long Bitcoin, you want to prove that it's all three.
Yeah.
I mean, it's everything.
Yeah. In my mind, it's a commodity for a couple reasons. One is it has scarcity and it has a marginal cost of production and that production is bound and sort of limited, within, Bitcoin, its own realm. Not crypto, completely because that's somewhat unbound.
Mm-hmm.
But it is bound. And on top of that, it's a bearer asset. It's not a liability. It doesn't need multi-party governance. I mean, its protocol is its governance.
That's a great point.
So when you own it, it's like owning precious metals. I mean, precious metals protocol is physics. So it's very different. We have some things that are immutable, like time and energy and various things that are in the atoms realm that aren't in the digital bits realm. But it is a commodity that you can own, which is very different than a currency, which is a system of liability or a security, which also is double entry, right? Mm. You've got an asset and a liability on those other financial assets. So from that perspective, it is a commodity. Whether it's money yet is another bigger discussion, because money is a special form of commodity.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, in my mind, completely a commodity. And so we should look at some of the infrastructure and trading of commodities.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an interesting answer, especially coming from you. For those of you that don't know, you've made the case on gold as a currency as well as anybody that I know. So, I mean, you know, do you actually have to make the case that it's a currency? I mean, do you have to be enthralled with Bitcoin itself? Is it crypto that, like, I'm going to ask like 10 different questions, I think, that are in my own head that I don't know the answer?
Yeah.
I don't feel like I have to know it today. I feel like I have to just keep, you know, educating myself on this, so to speak.
Yeah.
But on that, how do you think about that Bitcoin? And I've spoken to a lot of investors on this that have their questions largely around how solid Bitcoin itself is relative to the future of cryptocurrencies. How do you think about that answer?
Yeah. Again, this is these are not easy discussions, but. I think if you look at the store of value and medium exchange function, I think the Bitcoin is probably one of the most perfect medium exchanges we've ever had.
Right.
And that in itself is its commodity utility. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's money and whether it's an asset to hoard or be a store of value, which is a very important part of money, is yet to be seen. And I would say, by the way, the market does not think it's money right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that and if I'm going to take, you know, I'd probably take, you know, again, all of these we need to dive into much more, but if I was going to take, I actually think Marx has the best view of defining the difference between currency and money. And his view was really that there's a money equivalence in all commodities.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that relates all the commodities to each other, and in that case, you know, gold is the perfect, you know, the market decided that gold was a perfect equivalent here. It was the lowest volatility, and we had this whole discussion in our last discussion. It's got the lowest volatility versus all else. So I actually focus on that store of value and volatility because it's predictable.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the best part of money. Now, medium exchange is more important for currency, you know, just the velocity and the way we can actually transact in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, I think, very different things. And Bitcoin and all of these cryptocurrencies are probably the best medium exchange because of this one-way cryptography and the way you can actually transact without a trusted third party.
Mm-hmm.
That itself is revolutionary. And I think that's what this wave of capital is coming behind. Just like we had no idea what the internet was really going to do, but we knew it was important, right? So this wave of capital was pushing, you know, whatever, vans.com, to, you know, all of these things to crazy multiples. And I would call that sort of capital in motion. That,
mm-hmm.
That's the market's reflexive telling you what it wants. It
mm-hmm.
doesn't know yet if it's going to get it, but it's telling you we want this in some way, shape, or form. And that's what's capitalizing these things. It's very different than money at rest or capital at risk, which is bricks and mortars, things that are tangible, things that you know will always have value.
Mm-hmm.
These are very different things, but we have to sort of look at both of them.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, the way that you're talking about it makes a lot more sense than everybody and their brother has a metaphor. I mean, you made this comment earlier, which is a lot of people don't know what they're talking about when it comes to the totality of this discussion. I mean, what is money? You've thought a lot about that.
Yeah.
What is a currency? What differentiates gold versus a commodity? I mean, these are actually quite important discussions, I think, if you wanted to not be clueless on the entire matter. You know, to bring it back to Karl Marx, I don't think I see a lot of guys on Twitter doing that. And I don't know if you're 100% right. You know, John Locke's definition of a currency as part of a barter system, or, you know, Neil Howe, our guy. You know, a lot of people are not happy with what Neil Howe said because, look, it's got to be a currency. It has to be created by or through sovereign decree and or, you know, part of a barter system. Actually, on that, Neil, like, I'm sure you don't agree with everything Neil said. I don't. And he doesn't agree with everything that I say. I mean, hopefully as human beings we can do that without calling each other names.
Yeah.
But what was it? Like, because I think some people would say that what Neil said, you know, has some of the establishment views about Bitcoin. Do you think that that's a fair
Oh, for sure. It's the establishment view. But the question is, can establishment control a market? And I think it absolutely can't. So you know, Joseph Stiglitz was saying that it has no socially useful function. It should be outlawed and banned.
Well, is he talking about gold or Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, probably both. Probably both, but on Bitcoin. So But if you ask him the same thing about Donald Trump, and I don't know his politics, but he'd probably say he has no socially valuable function, he should be banned. But at the end of the day, there's a democracy, and he doesn't get his way.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, there's a market, he's not going to get his way. And so that's, I think that's the difference. I mean, sure, there's some people that this is going to take market share or political capital or capital, you know, from, that don't like it. Mm-hmm. But then there's going to be other people that are on the other side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was with, you know, the C-suite of a fairly prominent investment bank. They want to go into this purely because Jamie Dimon doesn't want to.
Oh,
like,
nice.
Like it's just pure game theory
yeah.
here.
Well, and they can yeah. earn a trading commission on it.
Yeah.
I think that might matter. I mean, at the end
exactly.
of the day, why are most people, I'll admit it. I mean, why would I not engage in the debate if I could make money on the debate?
Yeah.
I mean, this is what happens when there's money in the debate.
Right.
So, I mean, it shouldn't be, like, we shouldn't be held as, like, you know, inferior human beings because we want to engage in this debate and or make money on the debate. I think that's probably the most important thing that's driving the debate itself.
If you get into
kind of like taking a step a little more towards the platform and the technology
right.
and the infrastructure and the dollars yeah. behind it,
yeah.
What are your thoughts on that on that part of Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, I think that's the, and trying to break out who the net buyer is, again, because this is a commodity, and it's limited in its production. So I would actually say this is probably one of the problems long term with it being a good store of value and a good hoarding asset, I think it'll fundamentally always have high volatility, because unlike anything else in the market, if you throw more energy at Bitcoin, you can't change the production rate.
That's a great point.
You can throw more energy at gold, at copper, at, you know, financial services. You can flood the market with new, you know, penny stocks if the market's demanding a certain asset, like marijuana stocks in Canada. Like, you can always create something, but with Bitcoin itself in its own realm, no matter how much energy, if we throw the entire, you know, world's electricity grid at Bitcoin, it can't change its fundamental mm-hmm. protocol. So the problem is that's a commodity that's always prone to being squeezed,
yep.
and always being in backwardation. So I think that's a problem. But sorry, to get to your question, though, so what is that demand coming from? You know, what, you know, of that, you know, right now I think it's $36 million a day of Bitcoin being produced.
Mm-hmm.
And so from this pure, you know, marginal supply and demand perspective, and I know that it's not a, you know, this isn't a perfect flow commodity because there's the money stock of everything created, and I always make that argument with gold, so I know I'm, you know, I'm kind of playing, you know, a little bit on both sides of this.
Yeah, but it's on an hourly schedule. You did.
Right. So if you're going to have at least that much new demand for the new supply, what sectors of demand is that coming from? And I would say currently, you've got probably three or four baskets of people investing in it. One would be just the momentum traders. This is people.
Oh,
that
really?
This is...
I didn't think that anybody with any of these opinions were trading the momentum.
Yeah,
I thought they were just purely technologists.
Yeah, technologists.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay.
Yeah,
so there's
no,
those guys.
Yeah. Well, and I would look at this like some of the debates we had when the tin market was being squeezed. Right.
Anything.
There's like four or five
solar
guys,
stock.
You know, sitting around, you know, the W Hotel at you know, one of in Santiago at the CESCO conference, and, you know, four or five traders are just, you know, playing a poker table of how high we can squeeze this thing before someone's going to fold, right? Like, the market does that. That's what the market does. It's part of the whole price discovery. And there's some people that are actually reflexively trying to manipulate it higher too.
Of course.
So that wave, I think, is you can, you know, very much see that in the difference between, yeah, the 50-day and the current price. And so that's a big pool of capital coming in there.
On my methodology, by the way, like when I talk about the intermediate term trend support for any commodity,
yeah.
you know what Bitcoin would have to break for it to break its trend? It'd have to break down through
yeah.
10,000.
Yeah, 10,000. That's,
I mean,
that's about 50 day right now.
It's like, yeah. it's I can't give up the keys to what my trend level is, but the point is that that's a significant drop, and
yeah.
I don't think that bulls would want that if they're just trading the chart.
Right, right.
But anyway, so you said there's that community of people,
yeah.
and then there's...
Yeah, but behind that is still the fundamental, you know, there's probably the technologists, and then there's the, you know, the original sort of cypherpunk, you know, just we need a new currency crowd
yep.
too, right? So
libertarians, there are
libertarian,
a lot of them.
Yeah, so this is the other wave that they're buying it no matter what the price is, just like they're voting for Donald Trump no matter what his politics is, because they're really
yep.
voting against the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that cannot be discounted on how important that is.
So, now on the infrastructure, on the technologists, I guess, infrastructure development, I've been in a few conversations. I think the good thing that you and I have is that a lot of people want to give us their educated opinion on this, and they have a vested interest, and in some cases, as you and I both know, a very large, you know, hugely vested interest in this.
Right.
But they're making the hardcore infrastructure development case.
Yeah.
This is a technology. We're going to move to hash graphing next. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, this proof of market versus or proof of work versus proof of stake.
Yep.
That Ethereum's working on, like all these different things I'm hearing a lot. That stuff's pretty exciting.
Absolutely.
And it'll end with something like, well, if you thought that Google was big, it's going to it's going to displace Google.
Yes.
That's where the super bullish end of the discussion kind of comes.
But it's also the exact opposite. It's going to actually break Google, is what it's actually
fighting
for.
Yeah, that's
actually
the point.
It's not necessarily going to create the next one. It may actually create a thousand different distributed protocols that disintermediates them.
That's right.
And I think that's the technology part that's actually so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the, you know, that's the blockchain. And what this is all about is, you know, right up front, I probably should have, you know, disclosed a few reading materials and things that I like
that help
my mental model. I think probably if you really want the bullish, you know, how this is going to change everything, I think people have to get familiar with the writing of Nick Szabo.
Mm-hmm.
And many people, you know, he's one of the original cypherpunks, and probably, you know, a lot of people think he's probably a part of a group that was Satoshi Nakamoto. But he's got two papers that I really, really like, which is The Dawn of Trustworthy Computing and Social Scalability.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are two pieces. I mean, his writing on law and money is all actually very good as well. But those are the two pieces, you know, very specifically to this that are very good. And then the other thing that I should say is, you know, from a blockchain perspective, Union Square Ventures wrote a piece called The Fat Protocol. And it's really talking about essentially creating scarcity on the internet and creating more value in the protocol layer than the application layer.
Mm.
And this is where the disrupt Google kind of, you know, wave of capital is coming behind Bitcoin and all of these cryptocurrencies as well. Because again, it's capital in motion that's telling us where, you know, the market telling us things we need to build.
Mm-hmm. That discussion alone, we could have a show on, and I think maybe that might be next steps as we start to get some of the harder core investors in that infrastructure development community. It's happening at such a fast pace.
Right.
There are big power user forums. They're highly, you know, like I said, highly biased investors that want to see it work, and you can make things work with money. What I want to do next is get it. The fact of the matter is, we tried in 20 minutes and we didn't cover. We know we're not, you know, we're not as smart as everybody else out there. We got it. Thanks. Send us another tweet. But the reality is, we're trying. Okay, we said 20 minutes we'll talk, and then 20 minutes I'll take your questions because I think I'll learn a lot more from other people's questions, obviously, versus my own. Actually the first one was, what should I be reading? That, of course, you've just answered. And you know, is blogs.
Oh, sorry, one other that I think is very important on the money side of things and the gold. My co-founder and CEO, Roy Sabag, wrote, I forget, that it's on Medium and it's on his Twitter. I forget the exact title, but essentially Why Abstract Currencies Fail.
Oh, really?
The Natural Order of Money and Why Abstract Currencies Fail. I would say that's very good for the sort of anti-Bitcoin as money, not necessarily as technology, but as money.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be another one to throw in there.
Cool. All right, ICOs. Now, a lot of people have opinions on this, but cumulative proceeds from ICOs, or initial coin offerings, have reached about $4 billion. Are investors getting ahead of themselves, getting involved in all these new things?
Yeah, probably. But and you know, probably just like the early .com bubble, you know, most of them will turn to their intrinsic value of zero.
It didn't mean that
ways,
the .com didn't
exactly.
Exist.
In many ways, that's the point. That's kind of what this is supposed to be doing.
Showing our compliance department today, because literally every day there's a ticker off the pink sheets that proclaims their mystery of faith that they've always been a Bitcoin company, and the stocks are up whatever, 90, 100, one's up 140% today.
Yeah.
But that it's happening. It's not just ICOs. ICOs. It's through translation to equities. It's all it's but that part is that doesn't happen unless there's some bubbliness to it.
For sure, but this is the important thing because I've been through this cycle in a lot of industries and a lot of because I came from the Vancouver sort of penny stock
community, the epicenter.
Right? Like I mean, I didn't work for a penny stock company, but you know, you see that whole ecosystem, and I actually think, although a very good amount of that capital is wasted, some of it actually ends up finding real deposits, right? And the whole thing is a lot of this. So you have that first wave of wealth created by it could be a mining industry. You know, the Voisey's Bay discovery by Diamond Fields and the whole bidding war with Inco essentially capitalized Vancouver. And that house money that they're now up, you know, billions of dollars, has trickled through that economy for the next 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and again, 80% of that money is probably wasted, but 20% find deposits that actually, lower our cost of everything, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how the market works. And to say that we need to centrally plan, everything's got to be efficient, everything's got to be like that, that's just not how markets work.
Sure. Yeah.
So what's happened with these ICOs, in my view, is that first wave of Bitcoin wealth and the bidding up the price of what someone bought before, they now have house money and they want to go change the world. They want to invest in these new protocols. And they're not naive either. And some of them know that, you know, very much like some of the Vancouver crowd, they know that they're going to get in at half the cost of the next person, so it's no risk. But that also gets money into that ecosystem. So that's part of it. The other part of the ICO that's a problem, though, is there's no transparency. I think those numbers are totally fraudulent. There's so many wash trades of financing these things.
Oh, geez.
So we see this big number, but it may just be, just shifting back and forth between each other's ICO because there's no transparency. You don't know insider ownership. You don't know anything, really. So those numbers are highly inflated. But there still has been real capital and recycled capital going back.
And that's, I mean, when people worry about regulators, that's what they should really be worried about. I mean, when we're talking about, you know, initial coin offerings or initial public offerings in equity space or spinning an equity into ABC, I mean, that's where regulators have complete jurisdiction, obviously.
For sure.
Actually, the one question I didn't ask you, which I'm getting multiple times here, is how you think about Bitcoin relative to gold. A different question saying, will it impact the price of gold longer term?
No. I mean, absolutely not, because it will never change that energy equivalence. So when I look at, again,
reminding people on your framework, because
on my definition, I have capital at rest and capital in motion as two very different things. So capital at rest really is just bricks and mortar, raw commodities, raw elements, the periodic table, right?
Yep.
Like that's where we start.
Why we get along.
Yeah, and so if you look at, now let's translate this capital into an asset. Let's say housing, right? So you have your raw materials is essentially your scrap value. You know, the house may trade at $500,000 and just the pure scrap value is $100,000. So that's part of the capital that there's always going to be a market. There's always going to be a market for copper, for gold, for silver, for all of these elements in the periodic table because of their usefulness as elements. and so that's kind of a core. And then you have like this next layer of just capital in place. You know, the rest of the cost to actually build that house. That may go below that cost because there's no demand. You know, the factory moves and now the house is trading below its replacement cost. Or it could be part of a booming economy and it's trading 10 times its replacement cost.
Mm-hmm.
So these are different forms of capital in motion, but that base capital at rest is always going to be valuable in physics. And if you look at gold, it is duration risk-free in physics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, forget about markets. It has no duration risk because it doesn't decay. It doesn't go anywhere. So that shows why it has low volatility. But and then you have something like electricity. It has huge volatility because you can't store it. And then going through the table, you have the things you can't store versus the things you can. You know, pure energy versus pure sort of energy at rest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my framework for looking at all of these things.
And it's
Bitcoin.
And your view on that in gold is absolutely validated by the market. I mean, some people who don't like you would have said, and again, I think actually your quote, one that probably has people most, some people cued into this, was that some people just don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
So some people are going to say, okay, here's the guy who knows what he's talking about. But when it actually comes to gold, there's not very on this hand that many people know as much about gold as you do. At least people that I've had the honor to kind of have a real conversation about it. But gold, people also look at it as, okay, look, if a lot of people are speculating on gold, you know, there are a lot of libertarians that love gold. There are a lot of people who are anti-establishment that love Trump that love gold.
Yep.
You know, I think that that's more of their concern than how the physical properties are or why gold's
for
trading,
sure.
You know, currently. And some people look at it, okay, look, it's trading lower, Josh. Is it trading lower now in the last 3 months because of that? I don't think your answer is yes to that question.
No, not at all. I mean, I think what matters is volatility and just looking at what the market is telling us. Like
right.
I mean, to be a zealot that, you know, I think 100% of economists don't like gold, and like 96% of economists don't like Bitcoin. You know, they're fiat zealots. That's just what they are. I
mean, zealots.
I mean, that's just, you know. And by the way, you know, there's a lot of people that don't like their system.
Oh, okay.
And then you've got you've got gold bugs that absolutely hate Bitcoin. And they hate fiat. Fiat's pure air. You know, Bitcoin is a digital version of air. And then you've got the Bitcoin zealots that are saying that, you know, gold after 5,000, 6,000 years, that's it. We're done. We've solved it. You know, no more gold. It's useless now. You know, and I'm pretty sure they said that in the 80s and 70s and 80s after, you know, creating the new central bank standards. But, you know, the market disagrees with them. And that's all that matters.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's true. I mean, the zeal, I got to say, I mean, just from a branding perspective alone, I'd hate to be, you know, pooled with the 90% of economists that don't like it.
Yeah.
And that's just embarrassing.
I mean,
it's like, I can't really think of anything that they really believe that I truly, genuinely have a passion to believe the other side of. I mean, so, yeah, this is why I'm trying to get up to speed on the Bitcoin, obviously. Let's see.
So, I mean, again, and our platform is really about choice because, again, we haven't answered some of these fundamental questions between the difference between money and currency. So I think, you know, we have a platform that has 9 different currencies, 4 precious metals, and we're going to be adding crypto assets.
And on that, what aspect of cryptocurrencies has you most excited?
I really do think it's this you know, trustless, moving from what I think is peak sort of Web 2.0. This is the copy and paste internet, you know, where everything, you know, data is very very cheap, and it's easy to copy everything, and you know, this whole, you know, your data being used against you is pretty much the business model. That's what, like, 70% of the market cap of the S&P 500 right now is essentially data being used against you, whether it's, you know, financial services or internet companies. Sorry, the growth, not the total market cap,
mm-hmm.
but the growth is in services essentially being used against their client,
mm-hmm.
Which is, to me, is ridiculous. And we're getting to that peak. So again, that's the capital that's coming behind Bitcoin. Even if it's not Bitcoin, they're capitalizing the space as you know, what this part is peaked, where this big centralized control has too much control, and we want to now decentralize.
Mm-hmm.
And history's always gone through that. Call it populism in politics, call it decentralization or disruption or creative destruction in markets. But that's what's happening here. And so what has me excited is to be able, you know, to bring transparency and identity, you know, back into your control on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and move away from this centralized control, copy and paste internet to an internet of scarcity and protocols that actually can have value by, you know, from their creators, not just, you know, being sucked up into Amazon or Google.
That's an awesome answer. I mean, that's really, I mean, if you really think about it, I mean, in the last, it has to be in the last half decade, 90% of the data in the world today has been created in the last half decade.
Mm.
That means the whole world as they knew it has changed.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're trying to get ahead of the next big market cap that's capitalizing on the data, I mean, blockchain as a, you know, as a technology certainly seems like a reasonable thing. Here's another question. BTC futures are cash settled. He's writing in block letters.
Yeah.
He's not mad. You cannot borrow actual Bitcoin to go short. Thus, the value of arbitrage of spot Bitcoin versus future deliverable Bitcoin does not exist on futures. What else do I got here?
Totally agree.
You agree with that, obviously.
Yeah.
Could it not just get run over by launderers that will buy it regardless?
Yeah, I mean, that debate is a tough one. I don't want to necessarily get into right now, but on the first part on the question on the futures, that's absolutely right. That it's still hard to short that because you can't hedge your delta and you can't actually you know, it's very hard to borrow the underlying. Mm. And so I think, and for those reasons too, and even the nature of the settlement price that comes to these futures is keeping a lot of professionals out of these. So this is very much trader driven. You know, I don't know. I think I heard TD Ameritrade was
trader one way market driven. I mean, you could just lift offers. You could just keep going.
Yeah, but if you look at what fundamentally a future does, and I'm going to talk about commodity markets because that's the one I know best rather than, you know, currencies or securities. But in commodities markets, a future is a reflexive risk transfer, you know, from one to another. So what I mean by that is I'm a farmer and I'm producing corn. My exposure to the top line volatility of my revenue is massive, right? Like that corn.
It's the number one thing that matters to me.
That corn price matters to me.
Yeah.
Downstream, that corn price doesn't really matter to Coca-Cola, right? Or somebody else using some derivative of corn. And so they are less, you know, exposed to that price risk. Mm-hmm. And so there's a natural seller of that volatility. There's not really a natural buyer. So a speculator has to play that role. So they have to take their balance sheet and do all of their work to try to figure out how to buy these futures. And by the way, when they're buying those futures, they take risk off the balance sheet of the farmer, which allows them to produce more.
Exactly.
So it's a reflexive market. So people ask, are futures tail wagging the dog? Absolutely. In fact, I would say futures are the fundamental price discovery for the market at the marginal cost level. And the spot price is much more the volatility of current demand and inventories. And so futures are very important. So you look at, again, you look at Bitcoin, though, the problem is it can't be reflexive because even if you put more capital into this market, you're not going to get more Bitcoin. So this actually has a whole new futures dynamic that I don't even know how to describe yet. And just trying to figure that out. I would never want to be short.
Well, there's so many people in our business now. What's most actually, I got to say this before I say what I was going to say. So many people in our business now are the certified and want to be known as experts in all of crypto and Bitcoin, and they had a very tough time doing their day job calling the rest of macro.
Right.
Okay, and now they're over there. They couldn't do that. Now they're surely the experts on this. But how many people are actually looking at this the way that you just look at any other commodity, but because you called it a commodity, but then running into the very obvious roadblock that you get into, which is you can't, most commodity bubbles perpetuate supply.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people have a framework out there that bubbles end in oversupply. Okay, I agree with that, actually.
Yeah.
You know, people chase price. That's the characteristic of a commodity is that in many cases a commodity is a gift and good. As the price goes higher, I like it more. When it goes down, I don't like it. So that's just like housing's that way.
Yep.
You know, Cocoa Puffs are that way, whatever it is. So what is it? How do I actually say to one of my analysts, well, how is it a commodity if it can't, you know, we can't see people chase it with supply?
Yeah, I agree. That's the problem I'm still having with it, by the way. That's why I think it's always going to be volatile.
You're saying that because that can't happen, you're going to get, you know, bigger price gaps?
I think so. But again, I mean, but this is also, unlike all these other commodities, you know, other than gold, it's very hard to store most commodities. So it's still more flow,
right.
And that supply is much shorter horizon. Whereas Bitcoin, you still have, you know, the rest of that stock to be lent into the market, to be sold into the market. You know, so it's being accumulated over time.
Right.
So in that case, it is a little bit more like gold, but
because of the finite supply.
Yeah, but even gold still, you can increase production. You know,
yeah.
So it's.
But you can't increase it like at a parabolic rate or an exponential.
No,
rate.
No. In fact,
which you can with wheat and corn.
Yeah. In fact, my former boss Jeff Curry just did an interesting note, and I think he talked about on Bloomberg how he analyzed all the history of commodities, and other than natural gas, I think in the 30s or something. We've never been able to sustain growth in any commodity more than 10% year over year for more than a couple years.
Mm-hmm. That's a critical point. It's a self-governing component to
exactly.
The price.
And so in some of those in some of that way, you know, Bitcoin does have that. It has, but it just has zero elasticity, whereas these have limited elasticity.
Mm-hmm. Now on that, I mean, so people will say, so what ends it then? If you have if you can't create a supply bubble, does the government end it? Does another government end it? Does a government perpetuate it? Some people think the governments, like North Korea, would want to perpetuate this.
Yeah. Well, that's the game theory. Yeah. And I think I think the government's probably going to start to try. I think that's really what they're
the U.S.
doing
government?
Right now. I don't know. I mean, this is, we obviously look at this and watch this, and it's very important for what we do. But I do think that that they're going to increasingly get very worried that they've lost control, and they have. But a lot of people say, well, central banks shut this down. You got to remember, central banks created this. it was their control of the market that this is a complex system, and someone said, you know what, I don't like you controlling the market. I'm going to figure out a way that you can't control the market, and that was the whole reason of using sort of one-way cryptography in these Merkle trees, to create a currency that no one could control.
Deny trying to control. Ben Bernanke, as we know, did not mention the words U.S. dollar. Yeah. When he was devaluing it to a 40-year low.
Yeah.
I mean, this is
yeah.
So they did.
And so people, and people, on this point, I'll be sort of anti-central bank again, for a little bit. But, people say, that the size of the Bitcoin bubble. I mean, look at the size of the fiat government bond bubble. I mean, if I had three things. So I've got a grade school son. He's going to be going to college in 10 years. Just purely from a store of value. If I have gold, can I sell it for the same purchasing power, to pay for his tuition 10 years from now? I think almost 100%. I think all of history has confirmed that over long periods of time, it holds its value. It actually doesn't go up. It doesn't really go down. It holds its real value over time. That's what its function is. Now, if I was going to buy a European bond with a negative interest rate, nominally, we already know it won't get to par, just nominally.
Yeah.
And in real terms, I think there's absolutely no way 10 years from now. So as a store of value, that to me is a massive bubble. Now with Bitcoin, now what is it going to be 10 years from now? I actually think probably there's going to be far more of these protocols and not one big winner take all. And so I think it's probably below, but it could pay for his college in the next 2 months. So and that's what people are buying it for right now.
Well, that's what you
it's
do
a different
with anything
function.
That's
it's
going
a different
up.
Function.
And then we have to figure out for us lowly creatures who missed it. Yeah. One investor told me, well, what have you been doing for the last 4 years? You missed this. I said, well, I was building this place. I mean, you missed this. I mean, I don't
exactly.
Didn't see him spending his time trying to explain Hedgeye, nor would I want him to. How will taxation engage cryptocurrencies given Bitcoin's anonymity?
That's another big piece. And, I think very much, that's probably the biggest lever than shutting it down is sort of draconian, tax measures.
Yeah.
Because shutting it down... I just don't think they have the political power to do that.
That would be bad for them.
Yeah, exactly. I think it would drive more people into it at this point. It would
drive people to do a lot more very, very negative things to government people.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I, particularly with this capitalization, I mean, again, they have a lot of firepower right now for lobbyists, for, that market cap is power at this point.
Yeah. So taxation. I guess the other big risk, I mean, everybody asks about, who is... Sakamoto, but I mean, at the end of the day, what about that one? Well, I don't know how to answer that question. Some people say, well, they put a fork in it. As soon as there's some fraud, then you put a fork in the chain, and that explanation I can follow to a degree. But should I just blindly believe that there's not some dude who's going to just walk away with a lot of dough here?
Yeah. So the first part of that, what you said, I think is quite important from a short-term price perspective. I think that we have another period of rounding up and taking people to jail period that's probably coming sooner rather than later.
And a lot of the big bulls agree with it.
Yeah, so if you're talking about Bitcoin 3 years from now, I actually think it may be higher. If you're talking about 3 months from now, I still have no idea, just like the market has no idea. that's what the volatility is telling us. But I think I would actually think it's probably at a higher plateau right now, just because we're going to have a period of fighting back that's going to probably send a lot of these ICO people to jail. But is that going to end? And by the way, and a lot of the sort of late people that have come in to buy this, all of the 500,000 accounts that were opened on Coinbase recently or whatever, maybe that pulls out a third of them back out of the market. Oh no, someone's going to jail. I don't want to touch this. I'm going to come back.
Yep.
Some of it won't, and then the next wave there'll be more that come in. Like it's this sort of adaptive peaks, right? Where more people are going to get more and more comfortable that this battle is playing out in a way.
Well, if it's legit, every great market needs some serious fraud. some serious handcuffs, orange jumpsuits, fully loaded. And New York stock market? I mean,
Exactly. I mean, it's part of all these. The railroads. I mean,
you've been there. It's got to be part of this. If it's the real stuff.
Yeah.
Only a couple more. I want to try to keep it at 45 minutes, but it's something that I mentioned, which is this hash graph. Can you comment on blockchain versus hash graph? Blockchain slow, hash graph fast.
I mean, again, back to Nick Szabo's point of about, you know, one of the reading that I said. I really like his framework for saying that, you know, this is purposely incredibly slow to make it incredibly secure. I mean, it's not hard to make a fast computer. It's actually harder to make a slow computer. Because that slow computer you can actually trust.
Yeah.
You know, the faster it goes, the less trust. And this actually, again, gets back to this perpetual problem in money is a perfect medium of exchange is probably not a good perfect store of value, right? Like it's, you know, one that's super fast versus one that's super safe. And so money's supposed to be both, but they're kind of contradictory. So I actually think the, you know, keeping it slow and keeping it expensive allows it to be used for larger use cases. So right now, the transaction cost for sending a Bitcoin over the blockchain is about $25. So it's now actually the same as basically a wire fee, right? So it's actually now back to those bad banks. It's costing the same thing. But the difference is you can send, you know, $20 million from, you know, Zimbabwe to Albania without any intermediary for $25. You can't do that in the banking system. So the price is now on par, but the value for certain users is massive. And the fact that we're now capitalizing all of these miners is making the network more secure and slower and more expensive. But those all kind of go hand in hand. So I think, again, I think there's going to be faster, lighter versions that are less secure. But Bitcoin is probably going to continue to be slow, expensive, but very valuable for its use cases.
I like that. It's designed to be slow.
Yeah.
It's gold has properties that, you know, are hard to break too.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite back in the, you know, precious metal bubble, you know, 5-6 years ago. There was a J.P. Morgan report that said, we like silver because it's just like gold, but we can produce more of it. Like, what does that mean?
And that's probably, you know, the guy you need to be listening to right now. By the way, we're getting a lot of pushback on this, well, you can't short it. We know that you can short a little bit of it, you know, on these little, on wherever, Kraken, wherever you want to do it. Yeah. But what I'd be much more interested in seeing is institutional short selling of this sucker. You know, let's get this thing. If you do that, you're going to make the market a lot bigger.
Right.
And I think the fear could be that it busts faster. I guess if you're on the bear side.
Yeah.
But for me, I want to see this game. I want to see it on for real with liquidity, transparency, two sides to the market. You know, why don't they want that?
For sure. And by the way, that's something that we're working on. So
good.
So
our good. Thank you. Because I don't have time.
Yeah,
so, and I'd screw it up.
So our product called Block Vault is essentially the first audited insured custodian of Bitcoin made for institutional investors.
Oh, really? Is that live?
It'll be in Q1.
Oh, cool.
I mean, you can buy Bitcoin on our site now with the same sort of assurances of our company and public, you know, financials and all of that. But the actual Block Vault product will be in Q1. And what we're also going to allow is people to borrow against their Bitcoins. They don't have to sell it.
That's
so awesome. So that's like what we do in gold, right? Yeah. So we have a peer-to-peer lending site where if I've got $1 million worth of gold, I can borrow at a 75% LTV against that gold, so I don't have to sell it. Now we're going to do the same thing in Bitcoin, which now allows supply to be lent onto the market of actual underlying, not just futures or, you know, trading on a price of an exchange you don't know how to clear.
Yep.
We're trying to build institutional infrastructure for this market for crypto assets in general. It doesn't have to be Bitcoin. We think that's the largest and most secure for our clients right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be live for institutions soon.
That's great. Well, I think we're running out of time here, but so I've given people plenty of reason to be following you now. You know, Block Vault, man. BlockVault. Now I have an answer to give to people that are looking for liquidity. But again, thank you for, like, you gave people a bunch of books. lot of different thoughts on just getting the discussion to, I think, a much smarter place, if you will. So I certainly appreciated that. I'm sure everybody else does too. You can find Josh Crum on Twitter. He's quite popular there. He goes back and forth with me sometimes too. But again, thanks for tuning in to Real Conversations. We appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed our podcast. As a reminder, we are currently running a special promotion for new HedgEye podcast listeners. Get your first month free to any one of our investing products for brand new HedgEye subscribers. Email Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com to get yours. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. HedgEye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. HedgEye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgEye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of HedgEye, and are intended solely for the use of HedgEye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither HedgEye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions or conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.